Penguin Random House Audio presents The Vor by Brian Catling. Read for you by Alan Corduna. Prologue. That which is marred at birth, time shall not mend, nor water out of bitter well make clean. All evil thing returneth at the end, or elsewhere walketh in our blood unseen. Whereby the more is sorrow incertain, dayspring mishandled cometh not again. From Gertrude's Prayer by Rudyard Kipling. The hotel was ponderous, grand, and encrusted with gloom. Its tall baroque rooms were grudgingly fortified by vicious light that desperately tried to penetrate the heavy curtains and starched formalities. The Frenchman's room was a suite, the hotel's finest, but drab and without the elusive flair that sometimes makes audacious architecture appear natural. He stood naked and shriveled in the marble bathroom, the last feeble surface scars on his neck and wrists throbbing red, the deep plucking of his other wrist stitched back together. The dose of barbiturates had done nothing, and he was being mocked by flights of gilded putty and ignored by the wafting indifferent female figurines that shared the room. He stood with his cock in his hand, trying not to see his reflection in the gigantic mirror before him. He was small and prematurely old. He could summon no image to instigate the action, even though he had witnessed many and imagined more. He knew that Charlotte, his maîtresse de convenance, and his servant were waiting for him in the next room. He knew that the chauffeur might have brought him some fruit of the gutter or the docks to arouse him. He knew that they were as bored as he. He knew that he had invented everything in their lives, maybe in the world. Sometimes he thought he had dreamt reality itself, dreamt it outside of sleep, which now eluded him continually. The drugs sometimes coddled him a bit, but even the right combinations of doses would become unstable, wringing out the softness, the blur that he so craved. He made Charlotte write it all down, the quantities, the mixtures, the times. It must be there, concealed in the broth of unbeing. He sometimes doubted Charlotte's ability to keep accurate records. She could be making careless mistakes or lying about the doses. They were not working in the way he wanted. They had argued over the last few days. She claimed to be doing exactly as instructed, trying to calm him with her infuriating patience. But he knew she was tricking him with her cunning servant's slyness. Some nights, and most mornings, found him on the floor, crawling on hands and knees towards the thing that was strangling his heart. He had begun to sleep on the floor. The terror of falling off his shaking bed was too much. He stood before the smirking mirror. Last night there had been a carnival and fireworks outside. Music and gaiety had clawed at his upper windows. This morning was wet. He could hear the grit and spent festivities being swept away in a quiet rain, a tinge of sulphur and nitrate in the air. He raised his eyes. Max Kinder was standing in the gilded frame where the glass should be, naked and looking exactly like him. He lifted his tired arm, and Max mirrored it perfectly. This had been the comedian's great invention, the live reflection. And here it was. An act that would be copied throughout the century and beyond. His comic gestures of abrupt shock and dazed examination carved out the first continual comic character to grace the new flickering screen. He tugged his moustache, and Max did the same. Then Max pointed at the open wound in his arm, deeply vented and bloodless. He had died 9 years before, at the height of his fame, in another grand hotel, his wife cutting first, his hand gripping hers on the razor. This was a very different mirror dance. The Frenchman nodded and averted his eyes as Max stiffened back into glass. He knew he had exhausted his imagination, his wealth, and his libido. He knew he had lost a precious gift. He knew he had once been Raymond Roussel. He knew the hollow longing and guilt were growing stronger, and that there was no money or memory to hold on to. There were no facts to grip, and the fictions were worn out. He then realized it was time to die. And he did. Part 1. Chapter 1. The bow I carry with me, I made of Esther. She died just before dawn, 10 days ago. Esther had foreseen her death while working in our garden, an uncapping of momentum in the afternoon sun. Esther was born a seer, and lived in the expectancy of her departure, a breeze before a wave, before a storm. Seers die in a threefold lapse, from the outside in. Her long name was Irini Pester, and she had been born to Abungu in the Vor, the great brooding forest that she said was older than humankind. We said goodbye during the days leading to her night. Then all of my feelings were put away. There were more important rituals to perform. All this I knew from our first agreement to be together as it had been described. It had been unfolded. I stood before our wooden table, where her body lay divided and stripped into materials and language. My back and hands ached from the labor of splitting her apart, and I could still hear her words. The calm instruction of my task, embedded with a sing-song insistence to erase my forgetfulness. The entire room was covered in blood, yet no insect would trespass this space, no fly would drink her, no ant would forage her marrow. We were sealed against the world during those days, my task determined, basic, and kind. She had explained all this to me while I tried to serve her breakfast in bed on a rare rainy morning. The black bread and yellow butter had seemed to stare from its plate with mocking intensity, the fruit pulsing and warping into obscene ducts and ventricles. I perched on the edge of the bed, listening to her simple words glide with the rain, while my fear turned them into petrol, burning into my oxygenless hidden core. I shaved long, flat strips from the bones of her legs. Plaiting sinew and tendon, I stretched muscle into interwoven pages and bound them with flax. I made the bow of these, setting the fibers and grains of her tissue in opposition, the raw arc congealing, twisting, and shrinking into its proportion of purpose. I removed her unused womb and placed her dismembered hands inside it. I shaved her head and removed her tongue and eyes and folded them inside her heart. My tasks finished, I placed the nameless objects on the wooden draining board of the sink. They sat in mute splendor, glowing in their strangeness. For 3 days, I lived with the inventions of her and the unused scraps, the air scented by her presence, the musk-deep smell of her oil and movement. The pile of her thick, unwashed hair seemed to breathe and swell against the bars of sunlight that turned the room towards evening. These known parts of her stroked away the anxious perfumes, the harsh iron of her blood, and the deeper saturated smoulders of her unlocked interior. On the third day, I buried her heart, womb, and head in the garden, in a small circular pit she had dug with her very hands a week before. I covered it with a heavy stone. I obeyed with perfection, tearless and quiet, picking up the arrows that she had made and walking back into the house for the last time. The bow quickened, twisting and righting itself as the days and the nights pulled and manipulated its contours. There was a likeness to Esther's changing during her dying, although that transition had nothing in common with all the deaths I had witnessed and participated in before. With Esther, an outward longing marked all, like sugar absorbing moisture and salt releasing it. Every hour of her final days rearranged her with fearsome and compelling difference. Every physical memory of her body, from childhood onwards, floated to the surface of her beautiful frame. I could not leave her. I sat, or lay next to her.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?